Well, hey there. Welcome to Just Be Nominated, a podcast about movies distributed by Lee Enterprises. The show is hosted by me, Chris Lay, the podcast operations manager for Lee, along with Bruce Miller, the editor of the Sioux City Journal, and Jared McNett, a reporter for the Globe Gazette in Mason City, Iowa. Last time you heard from us, we talked all about some of our favorite mockumentaries in order to lighten everyone's collective load in the days following the election. And I don't know about you, but it's a list of good stuff that might still come in handy for anyone whose nerves are still frazzled, even a couple of weeks later. This week, strap on your bib, because this time we're talking about food movies, what with Thanksgiving coming up and all that. Along the way, you'll get some digressions into how many pieces of bubblegum Jared has chewed at one time. I guarantee you it is more than you think. Bruce reminisces about being at the LA premiere of Sausage Party. And I do a terrible job of describing the plot of arguably Steven Spielberg's biggest misfire. Lastly, the question of which fast food place makes the best french fries sparks controversy. You can check the show notes for links to where you can stream the movies we talked about and discover older episodes of ours as well. Before we get into the food movies, though, I wanted to let everyone know that Lee Enterprises just launched a great new podcast called The Ethical Life, hosted by Richard Kite, director of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University, and Scott Rada, Lee's social media manager. The show explores the intersections of ethics and modern life. You can find a link for that in the show notes as well, or, you know, search for it on your pod player of choice. This show kicks off after a short pause. We are recording this on the 1 week from today will be Thanksgiving.
Jared, what are you doing for Thanksgiving?
The extent of my plans are just my mom's coming up from Kansas City, and then yeah, we're picking up a massive gluttonous amount of food from a local place. So
just pile some blankets up and crawl onto the couch, watch some football,
make a blanket fort, and then just, you know, I don't know that I've ever seen anything in the afternoon after Thanksgiving. I am so out like a light that you could put, you know, the next year's best picture on in the afternoon and I'd miss it.
What about you, Bruce? You got a...
No, you know, my sister was going to come because we're usually together on Thanksgiving. And I really, you know, we're a hot spot. So I don't want anybody to come here and I don't want to be responsible for somebody else getting sick. So I'd just rather everybody just stay home. I was talking to Hoda Kotb the other day, you know, from the Today Show.
Oh, yeah.
She said that what they've been doing is they'll put an iPad at the table and they'll have their dinner together. And they're like, you're sitting there and you just talk with the person and, oh, this is good. Would you pass the gravy and, you know, pretend like you're having Thanksgiving. So I think that might be a good thing. Although I don't know that I'm making a turkey for one, but we'll see what happens.
Do either of you guys have any Thanksgiving movie traditions?
Well, it used to be I would always go on Thanksgiving to see something, and this year will not be that way. So, yeah, probably not.
One that's becoming more common, I know, because I've seen people like tweet about it and stuff that I've done as well, is watching The Last Waltz, actually, since that was actually held on Thanksgiving Day back in 76, the Martin Scorsese, the band concert.
Well, then do either of you go out and shop during the Thanksgiving weekend?
Usually, but not this year, yeah.
I don't do the, you know, showing up at 2 in the morning outside of a Best Buy. I don't do that.
Oh, I do that most years, yes.
What's the best deal you've ever gotten?
It's usually for me at this point, for years and years now, it's just been loading up on Blu-ray stuff. Most of my movie collection at this point comes from Black Friday stuff. But no, I don't know why, but I love those kinds of spectacles. So I will happily, not this year, but I will happily wait in a line at 2 in the morning when it's like 20 degrees out and I'm just drinking hot chocolate to stay warm. Just to buy a 3-pack of the John Wick movies.
Well, let's talk food.
Let's talk food. In honor of Thanksgiving, the theme for this week is food movies, which is pretty broad
could be a movie with a very specific food scene in it, maybe. The movies that are explicitly about food. So we'll just start this off. You want to kick it off, Jared?
Yes, absolutely, I do. So my very first pick for this is about a man who's a bit of a gourmand and doesn't shy away from eating some more eccentric things, and that is Dr. Hannibal Lecter, and specifically the movie that I picked was 2001's Hannibal, which Ridley Scott directed. And for all of my picks, I was kind of thinking about them in terms of different ways. And with Hannibal, both with the movie and, you know, the show, even more than any of the movies, strings through a lot of food stuff, because there are episodes like specifically named, you know, for very like, you know, fancy rich dishes and stuff like that. And the theme I was kind of thinking about with this movie is just food as both like horror, obviously, because the movies are horror based, but also as just revulsion too, because all the meals, even in Hannibal, are very, very like classy, and they seem, you know, very luxurious and everything like that. But obviously the underlying thing there is that somewhere in the meal is people. You know, I kind of think about that like in my own life, or at least when I was more of a kid. And, you know, you would try stuff and it would be absolutely gross. And, you know, then in your life, you developed these weird, you know, fears or bugaboos about certain foods. And I think Hannibal kind of fits in with that, although obviously with most people, I don't think they're accidentally eating people at all. But there's still the same kind of revulsion with certain foods. So that was my first pick, was Ridley Scott's Hannibal.
I am going to pick Big Night. When it came out, it was a kind of a cool thing because restaurants would cook actually the meal that they were cooking in Big Night, a timpano. And it was an Italian, for lack of a better word, lasagna. And it's the story is about two brothers who are determined that their restaurant is going to make it. But they really have to kind of gear this up to some big thing. They want to make sure that they spend all the money, they fight, they argue. And then you watch them make this meal and it's like so delicious. You think, I've got to have that. I've got to eat that. And it was good. I did go to a restaurant that had the meal. Stanley Tucci wrote it with Campbell Scott. And it really was one of the best things he's ever done.
Stanley Tucci or Campbell Scott?
Stanley Tucci. Yeah, Campbell Scott. It probably was the best thing he ever did. But for Stanley Tucci, it was a really a different side of him, because usually he either plays like a villain or he plays some kind of wild character. But this is a really kind of heartfelt thing. And Tony Shalhoub was his brother. And the way they fought and the way they were, you know, trying to make this work. And then it has such a sweet little ending where you go, oh, that it really was kind of like the build up to a big meal and then the letdown and then also the resolution. In many ways, it's like waiting for Guffman from our mockumentaries, where they're all excited because they think Guffman's going to show. And then there's kind of a letdown about all this. But it's just a charming little film that did really well. But the idea that restaurants would lean in and actually make this dish was, I thought, kind of the fun thing. And it looks delicious. So if you watch it, you'll want to make it. And I think summer you'll be able to find the recipe.
Awesome. So there was a local place that did it?
And this was all across the country. You would go and there'd be somehow you would find restaurants that would do the big night meal because they thought it was a cool idea. And it's usually, you know, a locally owned one. You're not going to find it at the Olive Garden or anything like that. But it would be a locally owned restaurant would say, you know, we should do that. That'd be kind of fun. And then we'll bill it as the big night thing because the film was well received and people had gone to it and they thought, I'd love to eat that, but I don't want to make it because it's really involved. But when you see it, the food, it's food porn. You really want to see how great it looks on screen. And I love that movie. And even now, it holds up very, very well. Big Night.
And I think that is on Amazon Prime, I believe.
Oh, good. Well, there you go. That could be Black Friday. Go watch Big Night.
For whatever reason, I have long, confused Tony Shalhoub and Stanley Tucci. I have no real good reason for that, but I've long done that in my head. So watching that movie would just be chaos for me.
Too much.
Yes.
Such a specific face blindness.
It'd be like having a Bill Paxton and Bill Pullman in the same movie.
Yeah, they're hard to separate, really. You have to say, now, which one is no longer with us?
Paxton.
Paxton, right.
Pullman, Paxton.
The first one for me is going to be The Meaning of Life. Monty Python, yes. The Meaning of Life from 1983, which isn't necessarily, I don't know if I'd call it a foodie movie, but there is a lot of food stuff to it, some of which I had kind of forgotten. Between, there's the sketch. Well, I mean, for anybody who hasn't seen The Meaning of Life, it is more or less a collection of Monty Python sketches that have just been given a tremendous amount of budget to string together, telling the story of someone's life. And the most notorious scene is of Mr. Creosote eating in a restaurant, and his whole thing, he's just this enormous obese man, and
it's so gross.
Yeah. He's projectile vomiting in a very, you know, vomitorium Roman bacchanal kind of way.
It never ends. Yeah.
Yeah. And then at the end, he's offered a dinner mint to finish off his meal. And yeah, wafer thin. That's the line that's always stuck with me. And yeah, it is definitely, you know, touches on the feeling of a lot of Thanksgiving dinners that I can remember fondly. It's that, that last sliver of pumpkin pie.
You ever noticed on Thanksgiving, though, later in the night, you think, I think I need something more. Meanwhile, you've eaten enough calories for 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
But I still need something more later on. Or was that real salty? I think I need something to drink.
Yeah.
So, yeah. You like the vomit scene.
I don't know if I would say that I like it. I think it appealed to me when I first saw the film in high school, and it's such a over the top, crude sketch. And so many other parts of that whole movie are very scatological in general.
Oh yeah.
It's very, very puerile, I think, but it's also touching on a lot of philosophical type things. And it has some of the best songs that I think the whole group of guys wrote for the most part. So,
oh, yeah. For sure. The Galaxy song, like I've talked about before, I think it's just absolutely beautiful.
Yep.
Yeah. I was really hoping somebody would have picked that solely for that scene, which I remember famously, I think Quentin Tarantino even said that was the only scene that's ever made him like wince, or that he thought, or that he was disturbed by it all. Was the Mr. Creosote scene from The Meaning of Life, because it, in some ways, like with Hannibal, it does make this very nice, like fancy food, just very disgusting and repulsive.
Mm-hmm. And it's just absolutely just revolting. I don't know what they used for the actual vomit.
Minestrone.
Oh, so gross.
Yep.
So disgusting.
Now, are you going to pick something that's pro food? Or are we going to have a lot of vomiting shows?
I do. I have another one that is vomit based, but the others are not.
Okay.
My next one is a little less grotesque.
Fingers crossed.
And when I was trying to think of something to do for this, I was kind of, you know, looking at what other people had said in the past. And one that I saw listed a couple different places that I hadn't actually seen and wanted to, because I'm forever watching, you know, silent movies from the 1920s from other countries. And I stumbled across a movie that F.W. Murnau did, the same guy that did Nosferatu. He did a movie in 1924 called The Last Laugh. And it's basically about this doorman who, he's like an older man, so he's close to retirement. And he loses his job as a doorman. He gets like demoted basically to working the washroom of this really fancy hotel. And he kind of like tries to keep that, you know, from his friends and his family, because it's this very shameful thing. But, you know, eventually that gets found out too. And, you know, he's very horrified by this and grief-stricken and everything. And the only real comforts for him throughout the movie are food. When he has these dreams, he has these dreams of having these very, you know, big, you know, loud, boisterous parties with family and friends where they're all eating very well and, you know, carrying on and drinking plenty and everything like that. And then even the end of the movie, it has like a false ending about like 60 minutes in where like the movie makes it clear, well, what would have eventually happened to this guy is, you know, he just kind of, you know, lives out the rest of his life working this very, you know, dead end kind of job. And that's all there is. But the movie then has this really strange epilogue where basically he like receives all this money from a kindly benefactor. And the end of the movie is him throwing this massive feast where he's eating, you know, like prime rib and everything like that. And so what I was really thinking about with this movie when I was watching it is just, again, kind of the idea of food a little bit as escapism and also a little bit of a class thing, too. The idea that what the doorman in this movie, you know, kind of sees as, you know, high society or, you know, upper class is food. It's not even, you know, a fancy car or anything like that. But the thing he most identifies with, you know, different classes and, you know, the extravagance of life is, are these very, you know, decadent meals. And I thought that's kind of an interesting thing that gets sprung throughout the movie. So that's the last laugh.
Well, that goes back a little bit to the way that I think overweight, what we would now call overweight people, way back when, being overweight was a sign of wealth because you could afford food. It wasn't necessarily just the, you know, quality necessarily, because if you could afford food, you could probably also afford people to make it nicely for you. Yeah. I will definitely have to check that out. And I know Bruce always loves it when you do silent movies.
Yeah. When you're going back to those silents and we're in, film class. Oh, great. Thanks. But you know what? It does remind me of one that I really love the scene. It's in the Gold Rush and it's Charlie Chaplin where he's eating his shoe. I love that.
Oh,
that
yeah.
That is so, so classic.
Licorice was what they made the shoe out of, right?
Oh, did they? Oh, well, that's good. Good to know.
I think it was.
I was tempted to include that one actually in the same kind of spot as this one for very similar reasons too. The same sort of thing of just, you know, of like class and, you know, who gets to eat what and when.
Bruce, what's your next one?
Super Size Me. Morgan Spurlock, where he lived on McDonald's food. Love it. He ruined his body by doing it. But, it, you know, those are things we just don't think about. You know, it's fast food. You grab it. And I think that's why we have an obesity problem in this country is because fast food is cheaper. And when you're hungry, you go for what you can get. If you can't afford more, you know, you're not eating well. And so as a result, he found that it was ruining his liver. And it's very fascinating to see how this all plays out. And it does make you think before you rush out afterwards and say, I should go to McDonald's and get something.
I had the exact opposite effect on me. I immediately went out and got a double quarter pounder. It was, I don't think I would do that now. I was in college at the time. So I was hale and hearty and, you know, could burn that off and, you know, wasn't having hangovers. I mean, it was the period in my life when I saw Super Size Me was the only time in my life where I could have just been like, who cares about tomorrow?
Chris, the real star of that movie to me is that the Big Mac enthusiast, Don Gorski, who's eaten like 30,000 Big Macs in his life, and he is a proud Wisconsinite.
He is. He actually, one of the reporters for the Wisconsin State Journal, George Hesselberg, who retired a few years ago, he had written a story about the Whopper guy or the Big Mac guy a while back and still is on this guy's Christmas card list. And so every single year around Christmas, you know, George Hesselberg would walk around and just kind of be like, yeah, I got my Christmas card from the Big Mac guy.
Nice.
He's a real American hero.
He said before that, like, Big Macs make up like 95% of his food intake.
Wow. And he's still alive.
Yeah, he's like 66. It's amazing.
My big takeaway from Supersize Me was, I mean, obviously there's the food component, but the premise of the film for him to eat McDonald's every meal, every day, was because that's what McDonald's ideal is. McDonald's wants to be the food provider.
Right.
And so it had this very, you know, capitalism run amok vibe to it, was the aspect of it that hit me when I was in college and saw it, as much as the actual health problems that it causes.
You know, until I was diagnosed with a gluten allergy, I always ate McDonald's. I was like, it was close to the office. It was like, well, I have a variety here. I could get McNuggets. But then when I couldn't eat in McDonald's anymore, I went through a really bad withdrawal. And I thought, oh my God, what am I going to do? This is like one of my food groups. And then I realized that McDonald's French fries are gluten-free. So if you ever get to that point and you have to give up all the rest of it, you can still have the fry.
Man, even now when they do their fries correctly, no other fry hits like those fries do.
I'm going to disagree. Everyone has a right to their own favorite fast food French fry, but Burger King, in my opinion, is just, it's like the ranking is Burger King, Wendy's, and then McDonald's.
No.
Oh God, I hate the Burger King fries.
I think, well, it's like a, was it cilantro, where it's like, you're one or the other. And like, I don't think there's any two ways about it.
Very true.
I'm not going to judge anybody. And I don't feel like anybody should judge me. Thank you very much.
Yeah, we are. I'm going to judge you. Just know. That's a judgmental thing. What about Arby's? Where do they fall?
The curly. Man.
They fall in the gutter. I don't know. The only good thing at Arby's is the Jamocha shakes.
Wow.
And the horsey sauce. Horsey sauce should be in every single fast food establishment.
I've long annoyed people with my fast food fry power ranking. And like I said, peak McDonald's fries is still the best, but the most consistently great one to me are like the Cajun fries that Five Guys has. Five Guys is on another level with their fries, but McDonald's is a second. And then the Arby's fries are on the list.
Five Guys is more fast casual. You can't put them in the fast food.
That's fair.
Like, for it to be fast food, it has to be a place that has a drive-through window. Okay. And I don't think that Five Guys, there might be some.
They do have a drive-thru, but I'll tell you, their fries are really good.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they're like, these are next-level fries.
This is going to be like the Jackass conversation last week, where we go all in on it, and then I end up just kind of cutting out, because there's no way this is going to be.
No, leave this in. Leave this in.
Oh, God.
Okay, so pick your favorite fry. It has to be fast food. You said Burger King?
I'm going to say Burger King.
Jared, what do you say?
Jared's McDonald's.
McDonald's.
Yeah, I'm picking McDonald's too. Because some of those other ones, like, I don't like the waffle fries at Chick-fil-A. And I don't like ones that have skin on. Nah, I'm a McDonald's person. And you know what's good? Is if you drop one in your car, it'll still be good 3 weeks from now.
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Okay, Chris, what's your next one?
Well, let's get the other puke one out of the way. I'm going to do Stand By Me, which is not a movie about food, but has such a memorable scene in the middle with Lardass and the pie eating competition, the fat kid who's made fun of by the whole town and then wins the pie eating competition, but has drank an entire bottle of castor oil beforehand. And so he wins the pie eating contest and then, you know, just projectile vomits out onto the crowd. There is something about that scene that is so fascinating to me, because you've got Stand By Me, the film, which is pretty bare bones. It's low budget for the most part. It's, you know, filming in the woods. And then the highest quality value that went into it, I think, was that scene. And they really went over the top to make sure that this projectile blueberry pie puke scenario really just lingered. And it does.
Well, look at how Jerry O'Connell had to live that down for years. Well into his adulthood, they would still bring up the fact that he was the fat kid in Stand By Me.
Nowadays, I think he just has to live down Joe's apartment, but that's neither here nor there, maybe.
He's still working, so that's good.
Good for him.
Stand By Me is one of those movies I've never seen, actually.
Really? It's one of the Stephen King things that are actually better than the Stephen King things, because all these short stories that he does, I think, are better than his horror film things that kind of go off somewhere midway into a whole other direction where you go, what was that?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But these little stories are nice and kind of compact, and they talk more about people than they do about issues.
And the collection that came out in, I think it's called The Body in the collection, but it's four seasons. And that's the one that has, it's got The Body, it has Apt Pupil, and it's got Shawshank.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, it's a really great collection of all of them. And every single one, well, of those three has been made into a movie, and all the moving parts are pretty much there. I mean, I think Apt Pupil is, I don't want to say maybe underrated, but it's certainly, it's better, I think, than people will remember it as being.
Yeah, didn't that come out at a time when there were other ones that were very similar to that?
Maybe.
It might have gotten overshadowed by some of those, you know, ones with bigger stars or bigger names in it.
Yeah, it's got this whole, Nazi element to it that I don't want to say hasn't aged well, because it definitely paints Nazis as being, you know, monsters, and rightfully so, obviously. I think, was it Brad Renfro?
Yeah,
it was a.
What was with that is that it was directed by Bryan Singer, and Bryan Singer's had kind of a roller coaster career in Hollywood because of other things.
Yeah,
so I think that's what kind of tainted that movie.
I still don't know how he. I mean, he's been, I guess, canceled, quote unquote. But anyway,
okay, let's move on to the next one, shall we, Jared? Uh huh.
Yes, I kind of had two for my next pick, although one of them we talked about before, so I'll kind of move past that one. It was Italian American, which Scorsese did, and the one that's related to it for the same kind of theme is a movie from 2014 about a bearded oaf who doesn't seem to know how Twitter works, and that's the Jon Favreau movie Chef.
Oh, yeah.
And I think Chef and then Scorsese's Italian American both really do a good job of, like, kind of, you know, getting into food as, you know, family and connections and that kind of thing. Because in Chef, Jon Favreau, like, is a successful chef, but he's kind of, like, lost a lot of his, you know, spirit and everything like that. And he kind of, you know, reinvents himself. And as part of that reinvention, he ends up, you know, driving across the country with one of his family members, as well as his extended family members, who's played by John Leguizamo, who's great in it, and then also his son. And he gets to, you know, kind of reconnect with his son over, you know, love of food and sharing meals and that kind of thing. And it's a pretty, like, low stakes sort of movie, which is what I like about it. And yeah, it just does a really good job of sort of showing the way that, you know, food can bring people together.
Yeah. And it takes a lot of the pretension out of it.
It really does.
So much of the movie is all about making a good Cubano. And that's the thing, where it's just, it's, you know, meat, cheese, bread, but getting everything exactly right and really caring about the actual product itself in the end,
mm-hmm.
aside from all of the, you know, family aspects of it, of the film. But yeah, it's a really good one.
Isn't it weird that he's like this king of Marvel now?
It is absolutely crazy. If you had told me when I was in high school or wherever it was, when I saw Swingers for the first time, that, you know, and fell in love with him and, you know, his persona and whatever, and said, this guy is going to direct multi-billion dollar movies and also be, you know, on the sidelines of a ton of Marvel movies. And he has turned into this just Hollywood monster in a good way, not in a Bryan Singer way, but
well, That's kind of why I love another reason I love Chef so much is that it's very meta, because it's in some ways also about just Jon Favreau's, like, the arc of his career a little bit. And clearly you can tell a little bit he's sort of, you know, making fun of this idea of, like, you know, being very, you know, successful with what it is that you do, but not necessarily feeling the most fulfilled because you're not kind of really doing your craft for your own edification.
Yeah, this is a career that somebody should look at very carefully, because how did he do what he did, and how did he convince people that he's the one to do it? I mean, he does all those live action Disney cartoons too, where he's turned Jungle Book into something, and you think, wow, where did this come from? But I do like him as the indie guy more than I like him as the Marvel guy.
Same. I agree. Iron Man is a very important film in the role of Marvel. But he's not an auteur. I mean, you wouldn't watch any of his movies. Like, you can't watch Zathura or Cowboys and Aliens and say, well, that is clearly a Jon Favreau movie. Whereas with Chef, that feels like the most personal thing that he's created so far.
Yeah, I agree. Is it me next?
It is you, Bruce. Yes.
I got to get a cartoon in there, but which one? I love Ratatouille, but I'll tell you, I really like Sausage Party too. So what do I go with?
The ball's in your court, but I would like to hear you talk about Sausage Party personally, whether or not that's on your list.
I will tell you something about Sausage Party. I went to the world premiere of Sausage Party in Los Angeles, and they were shooting hot dogs at you. You could pose for pictures with a hot dog. It was like, and you didn't know what the hell is this going to be. And then you see it and you go, oh my God, this is leaning into all those kinds of things that are dirty. And I laughed really hard, and I thought it was really kind of cool, especially when it got an Oscar nomination for Best Song, because I thought, they get it. They get the joke here. And it is a good use of those Seth Rogen and those people, their talents, because it's a nice little kind of play on what they like to do, but it's in a different venue. And so I do like Sausage Party, I got to say. But Ratatouille, come on. When you can make animated food look good and it's done by a mouse, it's got to be good. And you know, they've turned it into a ride too. It's at, I think, is it Paris, Disney Paris? And then I think it's coming to Disney World, where you're like the size of a mouse and you're going around the floor of the restaurant. And to see from a mouse eye view what it's really like. And to me, I it's fascinating. I love that movie. I think it's really good. And Patton Oswalt is a really good voice actor too.
Yeah, Ratatouille. It's another one very similar to Chef, where it takes hot cuisine and definitely not dumbs it down, but it reveals that everything is simple. It's just a matter of putting the care into it and the real craft behind it.
Yeah, it's an art. It really is. Because if you cook, I don't know if you guys are big cooks, but I have like five things I'll make all the time. It's because I know I can do it. But if I tried something new, there's no way in hell I could do it. Chris, it's your turn, I think, right?
It is my turn. And I am going to keep it in the restaurant world. And I'm going to go a little bit darker. I'm going to go with Peter Greenaway's film, The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, Her Lover. Is that one that either of you guys have seen?
No.
Long time ago.
So Peter Greenaway is best known for having these very sumptuous, lush production design, and it's very theatrical. Every single set feels like it's on a stage, but with that being bare bones. And it's about the inner workings of a restaurant that's owned by this gangster guy, and his girlfriend, or his wife actually, falls in love with one of the regulars at this restaurant. And so it's her hiding the affair that she's having from this violent gangster boyfriend, husband, and his crew of people who keep coming in to eat at the restaurant. And the food that's being made is really good up until the end, where I definitely don't want to spoil any of that. It's not a movie that I would say get the family together on Thanksgiving and watch it, but it is really fantastic. Looks gorgeous. Helen Mirren is the wife. Michael Gambon is the cook. And yeah, it's got a very early Tim Roth role. It is just fantastic. And it's sexy, and it's very foodie, but also dark and
very funny. Todd too.
Yes. Yeah. Michael Gambon is, I think of all the lines in the movie, I would say 80 to 85% of them go to Michael Gambon, and he just chews on scenery amongst many other things. It's fantastic film. I think it is on, this is what like I watched it on Peacock, the new NBC thing is streaming.
Really?
Yeah. Of all the places that it's on, it is on the same channel that gives you The Office and wherever else. So I definitely encourage everyone to get a Peacock account and check out The Cook, The Thief, His Wife, Her Lover.
And you know that Helen Mirren has another kind of food film, The 100-Foot Journey. Do you remember that one?
Mm-hmm. My mother loves that movie.
Yeah, it's a good, well, the food is, again, it's another one of the ones where you go, oh my God, I think I want to try that. It almost, you can taste the food. And I'm not really Indian food, so there you go.
I'm pretty basic when it comes to Indian food, but The 100-Foot Journey made it all look, I mean, you could almost smell.
Right, right.
And taste the foods that are in that film. It is absolutely gorgeous.
Have you ever, I'm sorry I mentioned theme parks again, but have you ever been to some of those things where they do have smell-o-vision? Because some of the rides at Disney World and Disneyland will let you smell what you're seeing. If you've ever ridden Soarin', it's kind of a trip over the world. And you'll go over orange groves and you'll smell oranges. You'll go over pine trees and you smell pine. And that's, smell-o-vision was around for a little bit of time where they would kind of put aerated things into the air during a movie.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't last, but they do keep going at theme parks.
Well, there were, the only one that jumps out to me is John Waters' 1981 film Polyester.
Yeah.
Which I think I think it might have been Criterion that put it out on Blu-ray not long ago, and it came with the smell-o-vision scratch and sniff stuff.
Yeah. But there's some bad smells in there too, so you have to watch.
Yeah.
It's like when you eat those Harry Potter jelly bellies. Ugh. You go, oh, wait a minute here. This is a mistake. We shouldn't have done this.
Those are awful.
Yeah.
Crime against humanity.
Yeah, not that bad.
You like them, huh?
I don't like them. I don't dislike them either. I'm just, they're fine.
And you play that game where like, all right, taste this one, see if it's good or bad.
I did plenty of those kinds of food-related challenges when I was a younger man.
You guys are crazy.
We ate McDonald's fries. That's why.
I like to brag about this from time to time, but I have a what I'm pretty sure is an unofficial record for most pieces of double bubble bubble gum chewed at once. I one time managed to chew 78 pieces at the same time. It was just a massive wad of bubble gum in my mouth. So,
did your jaw hurt?
Oh yeah, and my teeth were like humming for like 2 days with just like sugar infusion. So,
well, seeing you accomplish something in your young life, so that's good.
Exactly. My next one kind of fits into what we were just talking about a second ago with sort of, you know, craft and kind of working at it and things like that. And I picked maybe one of the most pleasant movies to watch possible. And that's Euro Dreams of Sushi from 2011, the documentary about Yuro Ono, who now he's like 95. He's a Japanese sushi master who owns this like Michelin 3-star restaurant, which is the highest rating you can get. And it's like this 10-seat sushi only, they don't have anything else, restaurant that's in a Tokyo subway station. And the movie like the food scenes and stuff are really beautiful. Watching him work is just like very inspiring. And even like him getting into like the way he does things, outside of food, there's even some just great philosophy to the way he talks about approaching and doing certain things. And one thing I found fascinating was even like the people that work with him and they're part of the like sushi related work seem to be like masters at their craft. Cause there's like a, an interview with like his tuna guy who just like works at like the, you know, the fish market and sells tuna or whatever. And even that guy is talking about what his like philosophy is for what tuna he picks to even bring to market to sell. And it's just fascinating to watch all these people that are the absolute best at what they do get to work.
I have never seen it. So if you say it's good, I should watch it.
Do you like sushi, Bruce?
I hate sushi. No. Look, if I'm eating fries off the floor, I'm not going to like something like sushi, right?
Sushi is one of those things where I don't know if I've ever, I mean, I've had good sushi. I've been to nice restaurants that have sushi that are like, oh, it's our, like we do sushi. But there's something about stuff like Jiro Dreams of Sushi where I'm like, I don't think I've ever had sushi. Like, even though I've had sushi, it seems like there's this whole other experience as a consumer that is just impossible to get otherwise. There's this higher level of experience.
There are other things at a Japanese restaurant that I take first.
Like?
Oh, now you're putting me on. You know, there used to be...
you said it. You teed it up. I don't know why.
Beverly Hills, there used to be a restaurant called Yamamoto's. And it was really good. And they always kind of gave you sushi as part of the whole deal. But there would always be like some deep fried something or other that I loved. And I can't remember what it was. If it was calamari or what. But those things were better for me because I knew like sushi, okay, yeah. And I would rather have something else that I could have. It all comes down. It's like the burger thing. Okay, if you can find me something better than a burger, I'll try it. But if I have a default, it's a burger. Do you see what I mean? Does that make sense? For some people, sushi is a default, and they will choose that as their, well, I'll have that. But for me, sushi is not that. It's just one of the things that, yeah, okay, I get it. But if I'm going out, I want something else.
Chris, what about you? Have you seen Jiro Dreams of Sushi?
I have seen like one of the No Reservations or one of, you know, a handful of these other food documentary series that had him on there. So I know of him and I know of that, you know, the restaurant that he has, but I've never seen the actual movie itself.
Just a great watch for just like a nice, pleasant thing to have on.
So Bruce,
my next film is going to be Waitress. And I don't know if you saw Waitress as a film, but it had such a heartbreaking story about the woman who wrote, directed, did everything with it. And it was this very sweet little film about a waitress, her relationships, what life was like for her, and how they made this kind of two-bit, whatever, stand into a real plot point was really fascinating. And now since Sarah Bareilles has turned it into a Broadway musical, you really see the value in what Adrienne Shelley was doing to begin with. And it's when you have that single-mindedness where you think, I can do it all. I can make this into something that I think we get really great things, really great cinema in particular. And that's one of those films. And Kerry Russell, who was not really, you know, at the time where you think you'd hire Kerry Russell to be in this. And she was really, really good. So Waitress is on my list.
My mom absolutely loves that movie and the musical too. And I need to finally get around to watching that because I love Kerry Russell and the Americans. And that's like one of my favorite shows of the past decade, but I still haven't actually gotten around to watching that movie.
It's good. And it's much different than the play. The play is kind of a Cliff's Notes version of the movie because it just goes in peaks around things. But the movie is very complex and you understand this relationship she has with this abusive husband and what all that means and how she's going to, where she's going to take it. But it's a great little film. And it's too bad that we don't have Adrienne around anymore because I think she'd be making very, well, she might be running Marvel. Who knows?
Honestly, yeah.
she would be a good voice that we didn't get.
Well, excellent. I think there are cookbooks for the pies that are all in that, because it's all about pies. She saves this diner by making different pies each day, right?
Yeah, different, and they have different names. And if you see the Broadway show, they'll change the names on the board every night so that they have different kinds of pies and combinations of pies. And yeah, it's marvelous. You know, if you go see the Broadway show, they actually do sell you pie there if you want it.
Oh, sounds so good.
Yeah, but the pie isn't that good. So you're all right. It's kind of pre-made and it's in a little jar that you have to undo, and it could be a big mess on the floor. But yeah, no, it's good.
There, I was made aware, a friend of mine from grad school, he grew up in a very small town, probably maybe 50 miles west of Kansas City, so into Kansas, very small town in Kansas, like population of nothing. And they only have like one main food place in town, and that food place, they make pies and stuff like that. And I was made aware by him that the old woman that used to make the pies for them, she actually entered her pies into some like national contest that like one of those, you know, like morning shows was doing or whatever. Mm-hmm. And she won the whole thing. And so I've been there a couple different times when I'm back in Kansas City, and easily some of the best pie I've ever had in my entire life.
What kind did you have?
All different kinds. One of my personal favorites for pie is strawberry rhubarb, because my grandma used to make that. And oh man, it's hard to beat a good strawberry rhubarb pie for me.
So would that be your favorite pie?
Quite possibly.
There you go. Okay, what's your next movie?
I'm going to follow along with Jared and the nice comfortable movie. I'm going to recommend the first in a four-film series that started in 2010 called The Trip.
Yes.
Directed by Michael Winterbottom. It is incredibly simple. It is Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon playing versions of themselves, both are actors, and kind of commenting on their own celebrity or lack thereof, and driving around the English countryside and eating food and talking with each other. And it is all about their adult friendship and family and growing older and careers and accomplishments. And it is just really, really wonderful. And you see delicious food all throughout, beautiful places. And the first one, The Trip, is in England. And then it's followed up by The Trip to Italy, which came out in 2014, The Trip to Spain, and last year, The Trip to Greece came out. And I think all four of those are on Hulu, and they are, yeah, just absolutely fantastic. The two.
Is it like My Dinner with Andre, where you just talk over the meal, or what is it?
Yeah, pretty much. Although both of them are comedians by trade, and very good at impressions. So there are lots of different impressions that are attempted and, you know, really nailed. Both of them have an incredible version of Michael Caine. yeah, it's very charming, but it's got a lot of depth to it. It's the kind of movie that you can really just put on in the background, but also, you know, take a deeper dive on. So highly recommended. And that's, yeah, and there's 10 hours of it, I guess.
My final pick so far, I've done food as a horror or revulsion. Food is like class struggle and escape. Food is family, and like food is a craft. And for my last one, I wanted to do food as a whimsy, and then also a little bit of myth making too, especially when you're a kid and like the sort of things you'll concoct about different foods and where they might have come from and stuff like that. And it's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from 1974, which, speaking of all-time great songs, for me, maybe the best movie song ever is Pure Imagination from that movie. And yeah, that movie absolutely made me obsessed with like the actual line of food, the Willy Wonka stuff when I was a kid. I would constantly be buying, you know, Nerds and Shock Tarts, I think, was a Willy Wonka also. And I think even the Laffy Taffy was Willy Wonka, if I remember right. Yeah, and of course the everlasting Gobstoppers as well. And yeah, that it's just such a nice, you know, simple, beautiful movie. And it really does kind of tie into that thing of just food taking on these kind of outsized roles in your life. I mean, they're all so – well, at least Charlie and his uncle are very reverent of just like this food and like kind of what it means in their own life. And so, yeah, I love that movie, and it's always a joy to watch.
And I hate the remake.
Yeah, the remake was not good. It was trash.
Sometimes, you know, this drives me crazy. Why do they feel they need to remake things that are good? Why don't they just re-release that stuff and let us see it in its original form? Because I don't need Johnny Depp as Willy Wonka. I really don't.
Especially when all the only idea for the remake for that was, what if we made this creepy? That was like the only point, really, it felt like to the remake of that movie. When like the original movie, that like boat scene is like, you talk about kinder trauma, like that's like peak kinder trauma. You don't need to go creepier than they do in the original movie.
The first one is even as kind of primitive as it might be, it still is one that'll just grab you and you say, oh my God, I want a golden ticket. I don't care about the two-bit factory. I want to go there. I want to see this thing. And a lot of it belongs to Gene Wilder, who just makes it so, so fascinating. It's a fault that you understand, but you don't know why.
Those Willy Wonka chocolate bars, they're not good. I've had them before, but like I was obsessed with trying to get those when I was a kid. Like, and all the other Wonka stuff, like I talked about, like I would eat Nerds all day long, and all those are just like, I know most candy is just sugar, but even by that standard, like Nerds are really just crackly sugar, and that's it. And still, because of like that movie, I just like wanted those so badly.
Did you have a Willy Wonka candy machine in your theater?
No, I wish. Boy, that would have been great.
It's fun because it shows all the things kind of moving through the places and whatnot. And it was one of those things where you fill a cup or whatever with it. But yes, a golden ticket. If you try to get one now in an auction from the first film, it's thousands of dollars. And these are probably made like, you know, paper in the day, and it was nothing. But yes, you don't. Okay, now tell me, Chris, you don't like Willy Wonka?
Willy Wonka's great. I got no problem with it. The remake is totally pointless. Yeah, it doesn't make any sense.
So you're on the same page with us?
Oh, completely. Absolutely. Yes.
Okay, for my last one, I had a bunch of kind of choices. I like Julia and Julia, where they cook all of Julia Child's recipes. I think that's kind of fun. And it also had Stanley Tucci in it, by the way. A lot. I thought that was fun. But I'm going to go with something because I just love one line that I can't repeat on this. And that's Sideways. Paul Giamatti is a wine snob. Oh, I love it when he talks about, well, it's let's just say it involves me. And I love how this pretension plays out because I think finally you see that with a lot of people about food where they think, oh, my God, no, you don't know anything about this. And frankly, I don't want to hear it. I don't want to have you go on a big rant about how you're better at deciding what we should eat or what we shouldn't eat. If I'm having the fries off the floor in the car, I don't need you to tell me what my level should be. And so I like the idea that he is this kind of person that I think I don't like and how he gets his comeuppance. So I really enjoy that. So it's Sideways. And at wine, I'm stretching with wine.
You know, there's been some like digging into that rant that he goes on about Merlot and that actually causing a decline in like Merlot sales after that movie came out. And there seems to be some correlation between those two things, which I think is kind of hilarious that a relatively small indie movie about some wine snobs like that might have actually had an effect on a market.
Yeah.
See, it works.
Yeah. And then there was one.
And then there was one.
The best one. All better than any of the ones we've listed. This is the one. This is the ultimate food movie.
Oh, boy. Well, the last movie for me is 1991 Steven Spielberg flop Hook.
Was there eating in that?
There was. There is a pivotal scene. So the movie Hook, for anyone who is unknowing about it, it's Peter Pan as an adult goes back to Never Never Land, or he's taken back. He's kidnapped and brought back after Captain Hook steals his kids, which is already like we're off and running into this is a ridiculous story. And he has to remember all the things from his time in Never Never Land. And he fights it for the longest time. But then there's one night where they're eating dinner, and the dinner is when it comes out, he doesn't see anything. It just looks like empty bowls, but it's the kids who are imagining all the food. And then at some point it clicks with him and he's able to see the food and he eats it. And it's all this crazy colored, gobbledygook. I don't know. Everything just looks like neon jello pudding in a way, kind of all swirled around. I don't want to say sumptuous. It doesn't look necessarily appetizing, but I loved that movie when I was a kid. It was probably the first movie that I saw in the theater and then made my parents take me back to.
Really?
Multiple times. Yes. Loved it as a kid, and it's hung on for a long, long time. And I remember there's a line in there where one of the little kids, right when Peter Pan, played by Robin Williams, realizes that he can see the food, the little kid says, "You're doing it, Peter, you're doing it." And that's when things twist. And all of a sudden he reverts to being Peter Pan and has the blend of adult responsibility, but also the innocence of youth and the lightness that provides.
That's fascinating that you wanted to go back to it.
I would have been probably, nine years old, thereabouts. So I definitely wouldn't consider myself to have been a very critical member of the audience, but I loved it, absolutely loved it. And now, I mean, I still have a very fond place for that film in my heart.
Aww. That's so sweet.
But it still is. Watching it now as an adult, it's way too long in the beginning. By no means am I highly recommending the movie Hook, but the sets are incredible. Dustin Hoffman as Captain Hook is phenomenal.
But Julia Roberts is terrible as Tinkerbell.
Very, very bad. Yes. And the making such a big to do about the sexual tension between Tinkerbell and Peter Pan is, yeah. That's regrettable.
Yeah, it's there we are.
I was a little bit too young to see that one when that came out, but I might've talked about it on here before. I don't remember for me when I was a kid, the Robin Williams movie that loomed the largest of those kind of movies like that was definitely Jumanji. I saw that one multiple times and watched that constantly on tape. So Chris has Hook and I have Jumanji from that time period.
Wow. Oh, that feels so heartwarming. But I reviewed both of those ones in the theater, so makes me feel like Methuselah. So there we are. Oh, did we hit all the food? Is there more that we missed?
We've hit all the ones that we would have picked. There's still a bunch of other movies that I think we're shortlisted for me. I think Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the feast scene in there is probably the one that was, I felt a little bad about cutting.
Well, so this week we need to eat something good at the movies.
Yeah. And there's so many really good Thanksgiving movies too, that don't necessarily have to do with food. Planes, Trains, and Automobiles is sort of the go-to.
The Irishman.
Do you like Home Alone?
I love Home Alone. Yeah. That's more of a Christmas movie.
Don't even get me started on how much I love Home Alone.
And it's coming up on its 30th anniversary. Can you believe that?
Oh, see, now I feel like Methuselah.
So Macaulay Culkin, I think, is turning 40. Well, let's eat something good this week, I hope.
Eat something good this week. And then I think next time Let's do Christmas movies.
Okay.
And we can even talk about the ones we really hate, right?
Yes, of course.
Because I think there are a few there that I don't ever want to see again. Thank you.
Excellent. And we'll probably take a week off in between just because holidays and whatnot.
All righty. Well, take care, gents. I hope you all are doing well.
Stay safe.
So that is our episode. You can check the show notes for links to where you can stream the movies that we talked about, discover older episodes, and find ways to contact Bruce, Jared, and myself as well, if you want. And hey, while you're making with all the clicking, you can subscribe to the show on Apple and Spotify and Stitcher and, you know, wherever else you listen to podcasts if you have not already. If you disagree with our picks, the review section in your pod player of choice is where to put all that grumpiness. The show is produced by myself, Bruce, and Jared. And I'm the one who records and edits it. As always, thank you guys so much for listening. We hope you enjoyed the show and are taking care of yourself out there. Enjoy the holiday. Stay safe. Thank you.